The views and opinions reflected in any of the stories narrated are solely those of the story contributor and are not necessarily that of the Nightmare Society. This podcast features adult content, so listener discretion is highly advised. And if you or anyone you know is struggling, help is available. Please see the resources in the show notes. Hello again, Nightmare Society, and welcome to another episode of True Horror Stories. So get comfy and prepare yourself for another episode of
The Nightmare Society.
In many rural areas of the American West, cutting firewood in national forests is a necessary chore if you want a warm house through the winter. Our home in mountainous central Idaho was no exception. It was normal for my dad to pick me up and my brothers up after school and head into the mountains for an afternoon of firewood gathering. My dad would fell the dead trees, then cut them into chunks. My brothers and I had the task of rolling the wood to the truck and loading it. We would continue this assembly line process until we had a truckload of wood, usually before nightfall. Hot, sweaty, and exhausted, we would pile into the truck cab and make our way down the mountain. At home the next day, we would unload and split the wood and stack it into neat little rows. This process was repeated until we had a winter's worth of fuel for our house, our grandma's cabin, and any extra for elderly neighbors. This particular afternoon, we decided to try a different logging road on the other side of the valley. This was well outside our familiar logging area. No real reason for the change, but my dad said he wanted a change of scenery. This logging road hadn't been maintained in some time. Large rocks and fallen branches littered the path. My brothers and I had to walk out in front, pushing rocks and wood out of the way as my dad lurched the truck up the switchbacks. Yard by yard, we slowly made our way up the mountain. That hike was physically brutal. As we ascended the mountain and got farther into the trees, this odd feeling started to set in. I wasn't sure if it was the exhaustion from the hike or something more. There was electricity in the air, like the whole mountain was buzzing at a wavelength just below my senses. In some odd way, it felt like the mountain knew we were there, and it wasn't welcomed to that fact. I wanted to say something to my brothers, but before I opened my mouth, my younger brother said,
"Does anyone else feel like we're not welcome here?"
My older brother and I stopped in our tracks and looked back at him. Both of us nodded in agreement. This moment was broken by my dad honking and motioning for us to continue clearing the path. Reluctantly, we pushed forward to a small clearing in the woods, where we finally stopped the truck. My dad, oblivious to our apprehension, or simply choosing to ignore it, grabbed his saw and went to work. As the wood was felled and loaded, I couldn't shake this ominous feeling enveloping me like a dark shroud. I noticed my brothers were taking occasional glances over their shoulders as we worked. Everyone but my dad seemed on edge. The sun nestled into the trees and twilight began to set in. As the light drained from the sky, my anxiety only intensified. It wasn't until my dad unexpectedly told us to load up that a wave of relief flooded over me. I could see the tension in my brothers melt away as well. The truck wasn't fully loaded, an oddity. Getting a half load was a waste, according to my dad. We would sometimes work into the dark just to make sure the truck was full. But tonight, he seemed eager to head home. With everything loaded, we started down the road. Although dead tired, everyone seemed to be in a much lighter mood. We were chatting and cracking jokes while trying to blow off steam from the afternoon. We were almost out of the tree line and into the valley desert. Going down the switchbacks, you want to be careful, especially with a load, even if it was half that. A brown blur jumped up from the downslope side of the switchback.
"Crap!"
was the only word that came out of my dad's mouth as he slammed on the brakes. Loaded with wood and traveling downhill, there was no way to avoid smashing into the blur. The truck finally ground to a standstill. The four of us peered through the windshield. Nobody saying a word. Illuminated in the yellow glow of our headlights was a crumpled body of a deer. Grumbling and cursing the deer's existence, my dad exited the truck to investigate. Doing as they were told, my brothers stayed put in the truck. I didn't listen, following close behind my dad. The truck was fine. We hadn't been traveling fast when we smacked the deer. Just some hair and blood on the grill guard. Hitting a deer really wasn't that unusual. The mountains were full of them. What was unusual was that the deer dropped so quickly. At faster speeds, deer could still be upright and sprinting away. That last burst of an adrenaline dump. This one fell over like a rag doll. Before even approaching the carcass, a deep, foul smell hit us. Deer smell bad when they're alive, but this was on a whole other level. It was the smell of decaying and rot. My stomach began to turn as we got closer. My nostrils were burning. Coming up on the deer, it was clearly dead. Really, really dead. The stench was so overwhelming, my eyes were watering. The body was a true horror scene. The deer's eyes were gone, replaced with sunken, hollow holes. As if to overcompensate for their absence, the tongue was swollen and black as coal. It could not be contained and hung out of the side of the mouth. The underbelly was split open, entrails spilling into the dirt. In the dim headlights, it looked as though the deer's fur and viscera were moving, wiggling, almost. Holding my breath, I bent down for a closer look and my heart stopped. The deer, inside and out, was covered in maggots. It was dead, all right, but our truck didn't kill it. Clearly, it had been dead for days, if not weeks. I backed away, retching. That electric anxiety came screaming back. My dad, always the quiet, stoic type. But right now, even in the dim headlights of the truck, I could see the abject horror in his face. His gaze was not on the deer, but focused down the mountain. Poorly masking the fear in his voice, he told me firmly to walk back to the truck and get inside. Made without objection, as I grabbed the door handle, a loud shriek came out of the trees. Branches were shattering and breaking. Something was heading up the slope towards us. I slammed my door closed just as my dad reached the truck. Before his door was shut, he pressed the accelerator. The truck launched forward, sending us over the deer carcass and racing down the hill. With my brothers and I yelling, it was hard to tell if the shrieking was following us. Our truck popped out of the tree line and into the desert sagebrush. Once out of the woods, everything quieted down. We were left with only the rumble of the engine and wind through the half-opened windows. Pulling into our property, the truck came to a stop. We sat in silence. No one moved to leave the truck. Everyone started talking at once. We all had questions. What was the screaming? How does a dead deer jump uphill in front of a truck? There was no way the truck killed it. Dad just shook his head and motioned for us to quiet down.
That deer was dead when we hit it. It didn't jump out in front of us. It was thrown at us.
We all just stared at him. He explained that all day up on the mountain he had felt uneasy. Not wanting to worry us, he kept it to himself. He described it like walking into a stranger's living room while they were upstairs asleep. That feeling never left him, and as twilight came, he happened to catch a shadow in the corner of his eye. Not far into the woods, he saw figures moving from tree to tree. He couldn't focus on them long enough for a good look before they dodged behind other trees. His stomach dropped. Working hard to keep his composure, he hurried us back to the truck to leave. It was after hitting the deer and discovering it was long dead that my dad pieced together what was happening. Something threw that deer to get us to stop. Before the shrieking began, he could hear something moving in the darkness beyond the road. It was a trap. Running back to the truck could have started an ambush or triggered a prey drive, so we walked back calmly to the truck. The second we were inside, he drove that truck downhill with no intention of stopping for anyone or anything. That feeling of electricity didn't disappear until we hit the county highway. My brothers and I never saw anything as we drove away. but those screams from the forest will never leave my mind. We did not gather firewood the rest of the season. For the first time in his life, my dad just bought what we needed, and although we started to gather wood again the next season, we've never been back up that particular mountain. The Forest Service has permanently closed and reclaimed that road. The only way back up into those woods is a long hike, one I'm not interested in ever taking again. Whatever was on that mountain, whatever threw that deer carcass, whatever chased us out of the woods, it did not want us there. It wanted us gone. Or worse, it wanted us dead. I used to work on the North Slope of Alaska in the oil industry. The work we were doing required us to travel far out into the Alaska Petroleum Reserve, which is basically just untamed tundra wilderness for hundreds of miles. The oil companies would build these long ice roads in the winter that would lead to exploration drilling pads. Our job was to go out after they finished the initial drilling and test rock formations for their oil-producing qualities. It was mid-January. The sun hadn't quite come up yet. And when I say the sun hadn't come up, I mean in almost a month and a half. Polar nights are intense. The particular well site we were traveling to was about 60 miles west of Alpine, Alaska, deep in the wilderness. Our job took a week, but we finished and were headed back to camp to finish our hitch and go home. At the beginning and end of the ice roads are guard shacks that you have to check in and out of for safety. No cell reception and radios work only up to a certain distance. If you don't check in or out in a set time, they come looking for you to make sure you're not a popsicle. It was about 4 in the morning, not that it mattered in the land of endless night, and we were halfway across the ice road. Travel was slow as the speed limit on the roads is only 25 miles per hour. When something appeared on the road in our headlights. It was a man, in jeans, sneakers, and a hoodie jacket, walking down an ice road in wilderness tundra at 4 a.m., and it was negative 20 degrees outside. It's not unusual for the local Inuit people to be out this far hunting. Maybe his snowmobile broke down and he's trying to get back to the guard shack? Seemed plausible. He did not acknowledge us as our trucks rolled up next to him. He just kept shuffling forward. He didn't seem cold. His clothes, while totally not appropriate for this extreme weather, appeared warm and dry. We also noticed he wasn't Inuit, but Caucasian. I rolled down my window and asked if he needed any help and if he was okay. He still didn't acknowledge us, just kept shuffling forward. His face was completely blank, devoid of any thought or emotions. The other guys in my truck suggested that maybe he was in an accident and in shock. I continued rolling my truck alongside him as he trudged down the road, still trying to get his attention. Even in this extreme cold, I could occasionally get whiffs of a peculiar smell coming off of him. He smelled acidic, if that makes any sense. There was just a lot about this guy that made the hair on my neck stand up. The guy behind me in the truck's crew cab had had enough of all this. He rolled down his window and reached out to grab the guy. He later said he was just going to try and shake him out of his stupor. But before my friend could reach him, this walking popsicle spun around and latched onto my buddy's outstretched arm. He glared at my buddy and then at me with this look of pure rage, not removing his hand from his arm. If emotions had a physical temperature, this guy could have melted the entire tundra that night. My friend groaned in pain as he tried to get his arm free from Mr. Popsicle. At that moment, this guy starts screaming in our faces. There was so much hate and rage and anger in that scream. It was absolutely terrifying. I slammed on the gas and spun out on the ice for a second before the wheels caught and launched us forward. Popsicle Dude still had a hold of my buddy's arm. He was trying to pull him out of the truck. He was running alongside the truck while the other guys in the cab held on to my friend to keep him inside. After several moments, It could have only been a few seconds at most. My friend tore free from this guy, and we hauled butt back to the guard shack another 30 miles down the road. We checked in with the guards and reported what we had just seen. The guard was looking at us like we were pulling a prank, but policy said they had to check it out regardless. My friend's arm was sore when he pulled back his sleeve. There were noticeable bruises in the shape of a hand around his arm. We filed a report with the guard, and we're told to head back to our camp. None of us really wanted to talk about what happened, and it was a quiet drive the rest of the way. We flew home the next day. The next time we saw the guard at his shack, we asked him if they ever saw Mr. Popsicle on his patrols. He told us they searched up and down that ice road for a solid 12-hour shift and saw nothing, not even tracks in the snow leading off the road. He told us it was a good prank and that he'd get us back for making him waste a shift driving around. But it wasn't a prank. Who would make up a story like that? And who would willingly bruise their arm for a dumb prank? We never got a satisfying answer to what happened that evening. I still wonder about that dude. If he even was a dude. The Alaskan tundra is a weird place, and that was just one of many weird stories from my time up there. My grandpa was born in the last years of the 19th century and spent his entire life in rural Idaho as a farmer and rancher. He had tons of old cowboy stories he would tell us grandkids. Most of them were funny, some were cautionary, but a few were downright creepy. When my grandpa was 6 years old, he, along with his older brother and a gang of kids from nearby farms, decided to go ice skating for the day. At that time, my great-grandpa was working as a ranch hand, and the family lived near Chesterfield, Idaho, now mostly a ghost town. It was a bright and sunny January day in 1902, and though the temperature was low, the sun kept things somewhat warm. They had hitched sleighs to their horses and headed down to the Portneuf River to ice skate. There were 8 kids altogether, and they were excited to show off their new skates from Christmas. Along with my grandpa and his brother, there were the 3 Robinson kids, Tommy Bear, and the Gooch twins. The best spot to skate was next door to the Gooch's ranch. The river there was broad and shallow, so the ice tended to be thicker, and if they did fall through, they would just get their legs wet. The kids spent a couple of hours skating when a loud scream came from a willow bush on the riverbank opposite of them. The kids could only watch as a giant man, covered head to toe in thick black fur, came lumbering out of the bushes. It was carrying a large tree branch and was screaming in rage at the kids. They fled towards the sleighs, trying to scramble up the riverbank in their skates. My grandpa, being the youngest, was at the back of the rush. He couldn't get a good foothold because of the skates and fell back towards the ice. The giant was now crossing the river towards them, screaming and swinging his branch. My grandpa was sure this creature was going to eat him. As my grandpa tells it, Lady Luck smiled down on him that day by the river, because as the giant was midway across the river, the ice gave way. It only submerged it to its shins, but it was slowed down considerably as it tried to get back on top of the ice. This gave my grandpa's brother enough time to jump down and cut the laces off my grandpa's skates. They left the skates and dashed up the riverbank and jumped onto a sleigh. As they looked back, the giant man was cresting the riverbank. To their relief, it didn't chase the sleighs. It just stood there hollering at the kids and swinging his tree branch. The kids were able to make it back to the Gooch Ranch, where they told their encounter to John Gooch, the twins' grandfather. Word spread quickly in the tiny farming community, and soon a posse was formed to hunt down the beast. Where the kids had been skating, they found footprints almost 2 feet in length. My grandpa's skates were found near the tracks. They had been both bent in half like horseshoes. The tracks headed west to the nearby mountains. The posse followed them as far as they could, but deep snow prevented their travel any further. The creature was never sighted in that area again. This story captivated a small community, and soon word traveled across the country of the, quote, Idaho Wild Man. Check the show notes for a link to an actual newspaper article about this event. I live in a very rural stretch of western Washington state. It began in late July when I was forced to make semi-regular patrols around the property on which I live. It's heavily wooded, very hilly, and wet with creek and swamp at the bottom. I had been made aware of local drug addicts attempting incursions upon the property. As most of you likely know, drug addicts have a natural tendency towards violence, especially the breed we have in my neck of the woods. I began carrying a rifle as I made my patrols because, as the old adage puts it, better safe than sorry. Very quickly, I found their tracks at the bottom of the hill, and I even managed to claim a gas can as kind of a war trophy. That led me to believe they may be aiming to perform illegal logging on the property, which intensifies my patrols. Soon after, I ran into a rather unsettling shape in the forest. I was on another patrol, standard routine procedure, when I passed an ancient cedar tree. I had been past this tree a million times, but I suddenly felt as though I should take a seat underneath it and rest a while. I sat down under the tree boughs and set my rifle and day pack aside. I sat in silence and stillness for a while, taking in all the sounds the woods have to offer. I almost felt as though I had entered the same state of zen I had the year previously, kneeling beside a natural spring after a heavy rain. All was well, the world was fine, and everything would be okay. I felt wonderful. I opened my eyes and rolled my head to my right to look out into the grove of alder trees. Glancing upwards, I saw a humanoid shape. It was roughly 15 feet up in the air, and had the distinct shape of a human head, neck, and shoulders, but no discernible bottom. It just seemed to fade away. The only way I can describe it is similar to the Predator films, in which the titular creature uses a cloaking device. It was very, very similar to this device. At its edges, it seemed reality itself was embossed into that shape. I sat and stared at it for probably 3 to 5 seconds, before an overwhelming feeling of dread and anxiety overtook me. I should add that I'm very tough to genuinely scare. I've been through a great many nasty situations that don't bear mentioning, and suffice it to say, this shook me to my very core. I was almost petrified, scared out of my mind of what would happen if I dare move. I finally mustered the strength to remove my glasses and wipe them on my shirt, and redonning them, I could see the shape of what was still there. The dread grew in intensity tenfold every few seconds, and my naturally calm, rational mind took hold again. I began counting down in my head.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
When I reached 0, I thrust an arm under my rucksack, grabbed the shoulder strap and my rifle, and sprinted home, saying a quick prayer as I ran. I haven't encountered it since, but believe me, there's more to the story. I began asking around online about my experience if anyone had seen anything similar. I was told time and time again to talk to Wen. Wen is the person you should see. I contacted Wen and we talked over my experience before forming some theories. In that time, I was still performing my patrols, although I made a point to avoid that area as best I could. I eventually decided that expediency dictated I visit it again, and soon after I did. All was well, and it stayed that way for a few months, even getting to the point at which I'd talk aloud in the woods about my problems. I once even left a gift of food for whatever was there, but after talking with another party, the activity picked up again. I still didn't see the shape, but I certainly felt the same anxiety. Early in my patrols, I found a strange L-shaped hole as well, very near the spot. It was very cleanly made, not something an animal would scratch out of the dirt. The hole was very fresh when I first found it. As summer wore into fall and fall into winter, strange things began occurring at the hole as well. Namely, large scratches were appearing near it,
about 2 feet long and perfectly straight, as though someone dug their shoe into the leaf litter on the forest floor and scraped as hard as they could. I took photographs of that as well, but sadly those are lost. More on that below. I continued my patrols, making totally sure not to bother the hole too much and keeping an eye on every angle around me in a complete sphere. I made sure to start affixing my bayonet to discourage anything jumping from the bushes or out of a tree if the rifle was slung over my shoulder. We have much to learn from Mother Nature, don't we? When I returned approximately a month and a half ago for pictures of the scratches near the hole, things got worse. Usually the anxiety sets in just as I would pass the cedar, but this time it hit immediately as I stood on the porch, camera in hand and ready to document my findings. It got worse and worse each step I took towards the hole, climaxing as I took my photos. I wasted no time. I got my documentation, the lost photos, and hurried back to the house, praying again as I closed the door, and a thought occurred.
It was windy.
The hole is at the bottom of a ravine filled with large old-growth trees. It suddenly got terribly windy when I was there. If stormy days are anything to compare, I would say winds were reaching 30 to 40 miles per hour at the bottom of a ravine filled with wind-blocking trees. The temperature felt like it dropped by about 20 degrees as well. I've been back since, but not often. Each time I visit, I say aloud that whatever is there does not have my permission to come back with me to the house, and most assuredly, nowhere else I go. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time.